The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on a freezing and frigid Sunday afternoon. It's good to be inside today, wrapped up listening to your radio, listening to good WILL locally produced programming here in public radio. Today we have a show I've been wanting to do for a very long time on trade issues, the economy, and also just sort of a refresher course in how Congress works and how it makes some of the crucial decisions it does, not only regarding media, but trade and a variety of other issues. And we're very privileged to have joining us from his office in Ohio, a member of the U.S. Congress representing Ohio's 13th Congressional District since 1992, Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown is the ranking member of the Health Subcommittee on the Energy and Commerce Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. The Energy and Commerce Committee is the committee that also handles all communications legislation. He is the author of two books. His first book, Congress from the Inside, Observations from the Majority and the Minority, is in its third edition. And he has a brand new book just out, published by New Press, Myths of Free Trade, a book that once again establishes him as the premier expert on trade issues in the United States Congress. It is a pleasure to welcome Sherrod Brown to the airwaves. Sherrod?
Bob, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, and pleasure on any show like this, but particularly with you moderating it because of the good work you've done. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sherrod. Well, let's dive right into the book, if we can, that just came out, The Myths of Free Trade. You know, the book is structured around a series of myths. Let's just start with basics in the sense that most Americans who don't really get much exposure to these issues in the news media or in general, you know, we hear about free trade basically as a good thing, as a source of economic growth, of something that generates economic efficiencies, that raises the boat, raises the tide for all boats, on and on. This basically a wonderful operation that all of us benefit by ultimately. What is wrong with that picture?
Well, the first thing you start with is who gets to name these things? And if you know, just like free enterprise is a good thing, free trade is a good thing. If the getting rid of the death tax is a good thing, even though only 1% of Americans pay. I mean, if you can name the entity or the concept or the bill or the program, you're halfway there. And it's hard to be against free trade. It does in fact produce wealth and dynamism in our economy, but just like free enterprise produces wealth and dynamism in our economy, you need rules. You need rules on free enterprise to protect the environment. You need rules for minimum wage, worker safety, prohibitions on child labor, food safety, all of those kinds of things. The same with free trade. We those of us who are opposed to these trade agreements in Congress like NAFTA and PNTR with China and CAFTA coming up, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, don't oppose trade. We just oppose this kind of unregulated, corporate, written, dominated trade that's done, that by and large pulls people down rather than lifting people up. And if you apply the same rules to international trade as we have generally in this country been successful in applying to our domestic economy, then trade or fair trade around the world really can work and really can lift people up rather than pull wages down and food safety standards down and all of that.
Well, let's go through some of the myths you talk about in your book, and you can pick the order we go in if you'd like, Sherrod, but what are some of the myths of free trade?
Well, I started with that myth number one, that Americans believe in free trade. What's the interesting thing about trade issues, I've been in Congress now 12 years, and we've had a trade issue every couple of years, a pretty important one every maybe 3 or 4 years during that time. And all this, I mean, you know this from what you've done with the corporate media. Almost all the major newspapers support these trade agreements. Almost all of the business elites support these trade agreements. Almost all of the talk shows and all that's on the public airwaves typically are in support of these agreements. So the public is hearing a very strong drumbeat that these free trade agreements are a great thing. But on the other hand, the public still doesn't support NAFTA, CAFTA, PNTR, those other trade agreements. When you look at any kinds of public surveys, the public has very serious concerns because they know these trade agreements are written to benefit corporate interests, and they know these trade agreements hurt their communities, they hurt their school districts, they hurt their families, they hurt their ability to make a decent living as incomes stagnate in this country in this era of free trade. So it's pretty clear the public just doesn't buy what the elite and the society are telling us all to believe about free trade.
Sherrod Brown, why do you think the press coverage is so one-sided? And I must say, I don't think there's absolutely any debate among anyone who studies this, that the press coverage of these trade deals is overwhelmingly positive and sympathetic to these trade deals.
Yeah, in fact, my 12 years in Congress, I don't think there's any issue where there is more consensus among the media than there is on trade, and they happen to coalesce on the wrong side. But it's pretty clear that, in fact, the largest newspaper in the country that opposed the North American Free Trade Agreement was the Toledo Blade.
And you and I both know why that was.
Our
dear friend John Nichols was the editorial page editor
That's right. And then he went to the Capital Times, and they opposed the NAFTA. But by and large, but I think there's a lot of reasons, and I'm not sure of all of them, but that the media are so of one mind on trade. First of all, free trade sounds like a great thing. It's what we learned in high school. It's what we learned if we took college economics. It's what all the people that matter in our society think. I mean, you kind of start with that. And I think another reason is publishers and editors don't lose their jobs because of trade agreements. They don't feel the anxiety that a steel worker in Lorain, Ohio, where I'm calling from right now, they don't feel the anxiety that he feels. They don't feel the anxiety the North Carolina textile worker feels. They don't even feel the anxiety of a computer programmer in the Silicon Valley that may be about to lose their job because of trade issues. So I think you start with that. But beyond that, I look at who people in the top echelons of the media, not columnists or reporters, but the top editors and the publishers, where they spend their time, who their social friend, who their friends are, who their social contacts are, and it's mostly the elite in our society, the people that run the corporations, the people who are the most influential in communities around the country. And they have reason to support these free trade agreements because they're all about helping investors, but not about helping workers.
We're talking to Representative Sherrod Brown today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sherrod Brown has been the representative of Ohio's 13th congressional district since 1992. So what, you're entering your seventh term now, is that?
Seventh term next month,
just one re-election. And he is the author of the new book that we're talking about, Myths of Free Trade, which was published by New Press just 2 months ago, or 3 months ago now. And Sherrod Brown, I think, unquestionably has established himself as the ranking expert on trade deals in the U.S. Congress, certainly on the Democratic side of the aisle. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Sherrod Brown, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And for those of you daunted by the subjects of trade deals, you shouldn't be. You'll hear today how they're really not rocket science, so to speak. But also know that Sherrod Brown is lucid and willing to talk about how Congress works and a variety of issues facing Congress on ethics, the drug industry, and a variety of issues, including media policy. So let the calls come and get Sherrod Brown's sage opinions on these things. Sherrod, back to trade, back to the book. That's myth number one. Then where do we go to?
Well, the myth number six in the book is actually North American Free Trade Agreement's been a success, and I'll combine that with myth number the last myth in the book, Free Trade's a Great American Tradition. It's pretty clear if you listen to the media about NAFTA, that NAFTA's been a good thing because we've seen more trade between the U.S. and Mexico. But what we've seen is lower wages in Mexico, not to blame all of our most recent economic woes on NAFTA. I would never do that. But we've seen a stagnant economy in this country where workers' incomes are stagnant. And we've seen the U.S. trade policy sort of judge Mexico and judge other countries and say the only way to come to prosperity in this world, we're saying to the developing world, the U.S. and the Western Europe saying to poor countries, the only way is to pass these trade agreements. When the fact is, the United States and most of Europe did not reach their prosperity the way that we preach others to reach their prosperity. In other words, most of our development, we practice protectionist politics. We protect it in the sense, not in a not in a sort of an underhand way, but we made sure our local industries could blossom and could grow, and we conducted our economy and our politics that way, and that's really why we ultimately were able to develop much more rapidly than some other countries. The other central point of that is that we, unlike Mexican workers and unlike workers in China and Vietnam and say Costa Rica, our workers have shared in the wealth they've created, and that's really the key to fair trade. When a Disney worker in Costa Rica can't afford to buy the shoes they make, can't afford to buy the toys they make for their kids, or when a Chinese Nike worker can't afford, doesn't make enough money to buy the shoes that she's making, or when a Mexican auto worker works in a plant where there are no parking lots because the workers don't make enough to buy the cars, that's really the crux of free trade versus fair trade. In a country like ours, where workers by and large have shared in the wealth they create, although less in this country today than 30 years ago, but nonetheless, workers in this society do share in the wealth they create, in large part because of unions and because of the way that progressives have lobbied our government to make sure that we have a lot more fairness in the workplace than some other countries. That's really been the key. But when we lock in a trade agreement with Mexico or China or Costa Rica that locks in the exploitative system where workers don't share in the wealth that they create, you never have a prosperous economy that can really lift all boats.
We're talking to Sherrod Brown, U.S. Representative from the 13th Congressional District in Ohio, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sherrod Brown is the author of two books, the most recent of which is Myths of Free Trade, that we're talking about right now. The Myths of Free Trade was just published by New Press in September 2004. Sherrod, you'll be glad to know that I think you have tied the all-time Media Matters record. We have a full bank of phone lines almost instantly.
Right.
Let's go to the phone lines now. And line four, Chicago, you're on the air with Representative Sherrod Brown.
Hello, Congressman. Hello, Mr. McChesney.
Hello.
Thank you for being there. I look forward to getting your book. I was active in the campaign against NAFTA with the Citizens Trade Campaign. We did turn around Congressman Sid Yates. I know you'll remember him. On the environment, with a lot of documentation about what would happen around the Great Lakes area. I wonder if you would expand on two aspects of free trade, if you would. One, exemplified by the Methanex case, the British Columbia suit against California, about a gasoline additive the state determined was poisonous and banned it, whereupon the corporation said, we have the right to make a profit from this. You don't have a right to protect your people. I'm worried that this would ultimately, there's no limit to the number of cases that can be filed, isn't that right? And you could ultimately bankrupt state treasuries and lead to the loss of self-government if you have to decide between protecting your people or allowing this to happen. The other case is with Mexicans losing the right, as you just referred to protect their local industries and so forth, and pouring into this country, would you discuss how the Mexican workers are being used to divide us spur this anti-immigrant debate in this country, whereas it wasn't their doing that they lost their jobs?
Thank you very much, caller. And I might, if I can sort of rephrase that slightly as you answer those, Sherrod Brown, it seems that a lot of people think that free trade deals are mostly about economic arrangements and market structures. But in fact, it's really a political issue of self-governance and governments and where the power lies over the economy, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It is. I appreciate. Thank you for your work with Sid Yates years ago. He was a member of Congress for almost 50 years, I think. I guess he was there, left, and came back from Chicago and left. I guess he left in the mid late 90s. And thank you for. And his successor, Jan Schakowsky, is a terrific member of Congress that's fought against these trade agreements. She doesn't need convincing by anybody. She's always been there on this issue, this set of issues. I think your point on the Methanex case in Canada and in California, and then another case of something called MMT, a manganese added gasoline additive, but that was the subject of a trade case, really do illustrate the point. And the important part of that is Bob's comment suggests too, is what we have seen now in NAFTA and in every trade agreement since is a shift from democratic governance to corporate influence. For instance, never in a trade agreement prior to NAFTA could a company sue a foreign government. It always had to be the U.S. government could sue another government on behalf, even if it were behalf of an industry, but at least if they were going to bring a trade action, it had to be government to government. Now, under NAFTA, a corporation, this company called Ethel Corporation in Richmond, Virginia, for instance, that sued a Canadian, that sued the government of Canada because the Canadian government had banned an additive, a gasoline additive, a manganese additive similar to lead in gasoline, that was made by this Ethel Corporation, Virginia. They sued the Canadian government, which had banned this manganese additive, and the Canadians were saying this clearly hurts our public health in Canada. The health officials had determined that. The Ethel Corporation said, you are taking our profits. You are expropriating our profits, if you will, because you're banning this substance. And the Canadian government settled the lawsuit because they knew they were going to lose. They had to pay a fine to the Ethel Corporation in Richmond, Virginia, and they also had to repeal their law. So when you see a shift from a democratic environmental or health decision to a corporate to the shift in power to corporate interest that way, that's really the underpinning most insidious part of these trade agreements that we're seeing the country. We're going to see that all over the world as these trade agreements continue, when a company can actually sue a foreign government. And I, Bob, you've talked before about what Clear Channel could do with BBC potentially, and I don't know, you know more about the good bit more about that than I do, kind of the direction that would go, but you're going to see these kinds of lawsuits around the world if we keep passing these trade agreements, that corporations, the shift in power from our own democratically attained rules and laws and regulations to corporate decisions. And that, as I said, is the most insidious part of all of this.
We're talking to Sherrod Brown, the U.S. representative from the 13th District of Ohio, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Indiana, you're on the air with Sherrod Brown.
Hello. I guess it's probably called the letting things trickle down, you know, basically giving the tax breaks to the wealthiest is the same sort of thing as the corporate people wanting to make sure the investors are taken care of at the expense of the workers. I just wondered what your thoughts were about the educating the people about these things. It looks like a lot of the words have already been appropriated by the right wing pretty well, and the media seems not to be too concerned about making fine niceties. I'm sort of wondering at the grassroots level exactly how do you point this out to people that, you know, the way they're voting, they're just essentially shooting their toes off one at a time? Thanks a lot.
Yeah, good question. I go back to what we talked about earlier, that this that these trade agreements are not popular with the American public. I mean, anytime Congress passes one, it's clear that congressional representatives and senators are going against the interests of what people in their districts are thinking and saying. So in part, we've won the education battle, although it's always ongoing because there's always more noise from their side than there is the good sense that we put out. But it's a question of really connecting these trade agreements to people's lives. And, you know, whether it's job loss in a place like I live in Ohio, and we've suffered about a third of the Bush net job loss of the last 4 years, particularly in manufacturing, or whether it's food safety or whether it's environmental law or whether it's an interest that people have through their faith, through their churches, or through international groups that care about developing world poverty and care about what these trade agreements have done to lock in exploitive authoritarian systems in places like Burma. But I think it's most important that we continue talking about these agreements and continue talking about what these trade agreements do to affect your schools, your communities. Clearly, when we lost a plant, an air conditioning assembly plant in Elyria, about 10 miles from here, Elyria, Ohio, a couple of years ago, and they were the most productive plant this company had, York Manufacturing, in the whole world, yet they shut the plant down and moved much of it to Mexico. And what that does to a school district, what it does to the community, what it does to tax rates for those still left in the community, all of those connections need to be made between lost jobs, environment, food safety, whatever, and people's lives. And that's what we need to continue to sing that song over and over and over again.
Sherrod Brown, are there going to be any major votes coming up on trade deals in the next session of Congress?
Yes, there will be. The Central American Free Trade Agreement's already been negotiated. It's an extension of NAFTA to the Central American countries. After that, the White House is negotiating something called the Free Trade Area of the Americas. If both of those were to pass, that would double the size of NAFTA and quadruple this number of low-income workers in what is now NAFTA. But the Central American Free Trade Agreement can be brought to the floor anytime. The negotiations finished early last year or late spring last year, but the Bush White House didn't want to bring CAFTA to the floor because they knew what it would mean. What it would mean electorally to them in states like Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan, Pennsylvania, states that have really, Missouri, states that have been really hit hard by manufacturing job loss. So that's why they held it till after the election. But it's likely going to be in the first half of this year they'll bring it up, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I urge your listeners, starting today or certainly starting the first of the year, to write their members of Congress, to write their senators, to call their offices, to give them very specific reasons about why these trade agreements don't work and how NAFTA has failed the industrial Midwest and the whole country, and how and has failed the agriculture segments in this country, and what CAFTA will mean more of the same and more bad news for American workers. And again, it's not just lost jobs, it's the stagnation of wages that we've seen in almost every community around this country, in part because of these trade agreements.
You know, Sherrod Brown, oftentimes, in fact, not too long ago, the New York Times' Nicholas Kristof wrote a column along these lines. You'll hear commentators who defend these trade deals say, look, it's easy for fat cat Americans who want to keep their good-paying jobs, but if we really care about the fate of the world, these trade deals are the only hope for developing economies to create the manufacturing infrastructure so they can generate the high standards of living of the advanced countries. And if we don't have these trade deals, we're sort of keeping the poor countries permanently in marginalized status. How do you respond to that?
Well, the answer to that is what we do versus what we should do. Not doing the alternative is not do nothing. The alternative is to do something different from what we're doing now. And we when NAFTA passed, a lot of us argued we didn't say vote no on NAFTA. We said not this NAFTA. We wanted a NAFTA that would establish a minimum wage in Mexico. Would say that American companies working in Mexico, moving to Mexico, would have to follow the same environmental and worker safety standards they did in the U.S., so the Mexican workers, in fact, would be lifted up. But there's a reason that the CEOs walk the halls of Congress on these trade agreements, because they are looking, as they said during the Chinese the debate on China's PNTR. Corporate CEOs walked the halls of Congress and they said, we can't wait to have access to these 1 billion Chinese consumers. No, what they really wanted was access to 1 billion Chinese workers at very low, locked-in wages. And to say that that brings up those workers and gives them opportunities is just wrong. We could pass these trade agreements and make sure workers in the developing world were paid better wages and had opportunities to join unions and all that. And as their living standards went up, they would, in fact, buy products from the U.S., and it could lift both countries up. And one more very quick example. Since NAFTA, Mexican industrial concerns pay higher wages in Mexico than U.S. industrial corporations pay in Mexico. Our companies, to Mexican workers, actually pay lower wages than indigenous Mexican industrial companies. And when our people argued over and over that we would lift up standards in Mexico by paying higher wages, that's just not what's happening.
We're talking to Sherrod Brown today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so please call in if you have questions or comments. Sherrod Brown is the author of the new book, Myths of Free Trade, which was published by New Press in September, and he is the representative, the U.S. representative from Ohio's 13th Congressional District. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, and the toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Hanover Park, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, this is Sam Turkman from Hanover Park, Illinois, and to me, globalization means are sacrificing American workers and America for corporate profits. And why America? Because last year's deficit was over $430 billion. And that's not budget deficit, that's trade deficit, money we owe to the rest of the world. This year's has risen over $600, and this will continue on. It's showing as dollar value in international money market in the currency pits keeps dropping, and this is like cheap thrills for family jewels. These imports are just like cheap thrills for family jewels. We are selling America. We owe over $8 trillion to the world, and it is increasing. What happens in the long run is that money comes back here, gets invested, and we clap. But in the end, we will be owned by foreign countries, and then at the Capitol Hill, just like in the 70s, we were told why public transportation systems and trains cannot be developed. We were told that it was because what is good for Detroit is good for America. And similarly, our politicians would be telling us that what is good for Japan and China and other investors of the world is good for you. And our standard of living would be, free trade is okay, but it doesn't mean our standard of living should fall down to the rest of the world. Where is our interest of people of America? I think we should just ban import of all the products that we used to make. And there's no competition with our manufacturers then, and they can compete with the rest of the world from their Chinese factories. And when I put that questions to this question, I was told, oh, you wouldn't be able to afford if everything was made here. I asked why we could afford 200 years for the last 200 years. How did we made you become such big corporations?
Well, thank you very much, caller, for that comment. Sherrod, that caller touches on a really important point, which is the trade deficit. And why don't you talk a little bit about that and how it's related to these trade deals?
Yeah, the year I ran for Congress in 1992, the U.S. had a $38 billion trade deficit for the entire year in 1992.
And maybe explain, some of our listeners might not be familiar even with that term.
Okay, trade deficit simply means that we buy more, we import more from other countries than we sell to other countries. Until 1973, we had what was called a trade surplus. We were selling more abroad than we were importing from other countries. Those days are long gone. We were in 1992. We had a $40 billion trade deficit for the year. Last month, we had a $56 billion trade deficit 1 month. So we went from $40 billion a year a dozen years ago to $56 billion a month. Now we will have somewhere, the caller suggested, $500 or $600 billion trade deficit this year, and that really means that we are borrowing money from the Chinese, from the Japanese, from Europeans, coupled with the budget deficit. What people used to warn us about, the twin deficits of a trade deficit and a budget deficit, will reach this year, in the coming years, will reach close to it, to a $1 trillion every year that we are borrowing from abroad. And ultimately what that means is, and I'm not an economist, but ultimately what that means is that some countries aren't forever going to be lending us that money. At some point that they're going to say enough is enough, and all kinds of people have all kinds of predictions for what happens then. But clearly with this kind of activity, this kind of behavior from us as a country, us as a government, us as consumers, and policymakers and all of us, that it's setting us up for problems in the future. And there seems to be the Wall Street Journal used to rail against budget deficits and used to even be concerned about trade deficits. And now, because it's their friends in the White House, those things are just fine and we don't have to worry about them. But in fact, we do. And especially when you look at our our bilateral trade deficit with China, $10 billion 15 years ago, $150 billion now with our trade deficit with China. And we're building them into both an economic power, which is fine as long as they are taking care of their people a little better than they are. We're also building them into a military power with all kinds of access to all kinds of aeronautical information and all kinds of things that might compromise our national security at some point. So for purposes of both national security and economic security as a nation, our neighborhoods and our families and our communities, we need to look very seriously at the direction we're taking trade policy.
We're talking to Sherrod Brown today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you want to call in, the phone lines, we have a couple open, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Representative Sherrod Brown.
Hi. I was curious your opinion. Obviously, there's a zillion things you could point to. How did we get into the sorry state? But clearly one of them, I think, at least, and I would guess that you would agree, is the sorry state of academic economics. You mentioned, Bob McChesney mentioned Nicholas Kristof writing in the New York Times. Clearly a lot of people are, who write in the New York Times are influenced by what economic experts say, and the overwhelming weight of the profession is free trade uber alles, the orthodoxy, and never mind the details. And I was wondering, I'll state my personal interest in this, as I'm a PhD student at the university here, and you would not believe the nonsense that we're taught, that the macroeconomics are taught that the optimal government policy is deflation, and, of course, unions cause unemployment, and minimum wage causes unemployment, and the government can't do anything if there's a recession because people would just save any tax cut. And so, it's like from Mars. But I was curious what you thought about it. After all, University of Illinois this isn't a private institution, right? It's a state-sponsored land-grant institution. You would think that at some point someone would cry foul, like how workers' tax dollars are supporting this institution where this stuff is being taught. And you could see the damage, that's going to come years down the line as the people now being trained are now going to be at the IMF and the World Bank and the U.S. Treasury Department. Delivering their expert opinion that's been inculcated in them. So I wondered, as a member of Congress, whether this is something that concerns you, and maybe at some point there might be some kind of congressional investigation as to how public funds are being spent in the creation of academic economics.
Thank you. Music to our ears. I'm always a bit puzzled and maybe even discouraged sometimes when I hear people talk about all this political correctness on campus and only leftists are teaching in schools and only liberals are this and that, and they roll that, Bob, into the terms of liberal media and all that, and I'm still looking for all those things to happen. The fact is that economics courses, as you know better than I since you're a PhD candidate, are clearly so strongly biased against fair trade for these free trade policies. But there's a couple of good pieces of good news. When I was in college 30 years ago, there was I took some economics courses, and the course that everybody took, every freshman took in economics was, we use a textbook of Paul Samuelson. I believe he taught at MIT, I'm not sure, but mm-hmm. He is now in his late 80s. He was very much a conventional, but a brilliant, I believe, professor and writer about economics, and pretty orthodox. Well, he is now, I believe, at the age of 88 or 89, has been writing articles saying that we ought to relook at these free trade agreements, that trade is not, we basically saying we've been wrong over the years teaching it the way we do. Then there's another gentleman whom I'm sure the caller's familiar with, Joe Stiglitz, who was head of the World Bank, and he's begun to write much more forcefully about what the U.S. is doing around the world in the sort of hypocrisy that I point out as one of the myths in my book, that we didn't get where we did by this kind of unregulated corporate free trade, but instead that we in our country made sure our industries got ahead, and we didn't have any outside wealthy countries or outside wealthy investors sort of directing our government and our economic policies the way that we are doing that in the developing world now. So
I think those are some rays of hope, and particularly, and the third ray of hope is you calling, and that you, you know, you don't buy this stuff about minimum wage, and you don't buy this stuff about labor unions, you don't buy this stuff about free trade that they continue to propagate. And I think that it would be important if you can talk to some local state elected officials in Illinois, from the governor on down to state senators, state representatives, and tell them of your concerns with the way that economics is being taught. That there's the talk about political correctness. I mean, there's only one way to teach economics in a lot of our schools, and in our great universities. The University of Illinois is a great university, and anything, and you can, you know, just getting some conflicting dissident views in there, dissenting voices that would look at teaching economics a little different than the orthodox way that's kind of gotten us into this mess.
Joseph Stiglitz now is a professor of economics at Columbia University. Last week, Sherrod Brown, we had Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and the Princeton economist, on the air with us. Krugman at one time was a quite strong supporter of these trade deals, and I think he is having some second thoughts himself based on the comments he gave us on the show last week.
He's been good on, I mean, he's been as good as anybody on taking on Bush economic policies, but he's always been pretty much a free trader. But I'm glad you detect a movement even in him. I mean, I don't know how these guys can look at it. I mean, certainly if you only believe in theory and you don't really try to figure how these theories work out in practice, maybe you come down there. But I don't know how any of these economists that really do pay attention to the world around them can think that these free trade agreements, by any stretch of the imagination, that they work for the poor in Nicaragua, or they work for the middle class in Illinois.
We're talking to Representative Sherrod Brown from Ohio's 13th Congressional District today in Media Matters. Sherrod Brown is the author of the new book, Myths of Free Trade, published by New Press in September 2004. We've got a few callers, and I promise—
Bob, I would interject one thing.
Sure.
Just for your listeners. I get none of the royalties for this book. The money from any author's proceeds go to two groups. One is called Results. It's an international, it's a group in Washington, citizens group that lobbies for fair trade agreements and works to try to eradicate AIDS, TB, and malaria in the developing world. And the other group is Cleveland Jobs with Justice. And these two groups the group that's devoted to social and economic justice concerns in Northeast Ohio, these two groups get any author's proceeds. So another reason to buy the book is the congressman that wrote it gets no money for it.
Well, I think that's an explanation for why on the cover of the book there is a laudatory comment by Studs Terkel proclaiming you one of the great public servants of our times.
Good. Thanks.
So let's go back to the phone lines on that note. And line two, Champagne, you're on the air with Representative Sherrod Brown.
This is line two?
Yes, it is.
Yes. I find it ironic that it was the U.S. government that a few years ago that forced a lot of poor countries to open up their markets, preaching that if they did, they would reap the benefits. But it seems to me that over the period of time, now that when people do compete, and they can compete much more efficiently, you know, given the lower wage structures and so on and so forth, then it hits home, then people start thinking about these issues. What was the congressman's position when trade agreements are being negotiated, like the WTOs, which are clearly designed to give countries advantage on the world market to compete, but then to say, oh, no, this is no longer a level playing field when you start losing? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
So, Sherrod, is there an element of opportunism in your side of the case?
Well, there always is. Nobody's pure in any of these decisions. There's always some contradictions and people in politics are having the winds blow from all different directions. And I you can particularly see that with what happened with agriculture. Congress, on the one hand, says, as the president does, let's have open markets and free trade. And on the other, Congress then passes a huge bill, a subsidy bill for agriculture, for U.S. agriculture, that of course helps corporate agriculture, not small farms in Champaign, Urbana area in southern Illinois. In the end, these agreements are written not on, when I say unregulated free trade, that's much of what this is. But there are always elements put in these bills that protect certain industries. So in the end, it's a combination of
of trade by ideology, unregulated free trade, mixed with corporate with a corporate welfare agenda that companies come to Congress and extract, if you will, extract from the Ways and Means Committee. So these agreements are never. If these agreements were purely let's knock down all trade barriers and free and let's trade freely, then NAFTA would have been 3 pages instead of 2,000. So it's just like the tax code that way, that it's loaded, that when we say it's tax reform in Congress, we instead come up with more tax complications, but subsidies to all kinds of bows to corporate welfare. That's too often how Congress works, and you can see it just this week, the end product of it, when the drug industry, after pushing through Congress a Medicare bill that gave them almost $200 billion more profits, that this week they announced they were hiring the chairman of the committee, the Republican from Louisiana, Billy Tozan, the chairman of the committee that wrote this bill that I sit on, and to a $2 million a year contract to represent the drug industry in Congress as he retires from his congressional seat. I mean, these kinds of this place now has become so corrupt and so responsive to every corporate almsgiver, if you will, or every corporate representative that comes to Congress, that the public at some point is going to have to take it back.
You know, you wrote a book, shared Congress from the Inside, Observations from the Majority and the Minority, now in its third edition. You've been in Congress since January 1993. Have you seen an increase in the amount of corruption, an increase in the amount of corporate influence in that time span, or has it pretty much been at the level you just described throughout?
There's no question it gets worse every year. It's gotten markedly worse in the last 4 or 5 years. It almost makes me yearn for the days of Newt Gingrich, although I wouldn't go that far. But this crowd now, everything is up for sale, and just the way that Congress responded to September 11th with more tax breaks and more bailouts to every industry that could claim any tie to terrorism, the way this Congress has responded on trade agreements on the prescription drug bill was probably the worst example of corporate slime that I've ever seen in 12 years in Congress and a good many years in state government, where the amount of money, the insurance industry got a $45 billion straight gift from Congress, and the drug industry got an almost $200 billion extra excess profits, extra from what they already had, and they're the most profitable industry in America, and seniors got what was left, and we'll get more dollars put on, more billions of dollars put on the national debt for our grandchildren. I mean, on issue after issue, from the tax cuts to environmental regulation to what's happened with the media. I mean, you know, Bob, from studying for years what's happened in the media in this country, how much more influential corporate media is in Congress, and then the other side of that, how influential corporate media is to the public. And we've seen a continued accelerated downward spiral in the public interest and people that are fighting for the public interest and lots and lots more people feeding at the public trough, and the media aren't writing about it enough. There are some very courageous people in the media that are. My wife, whose name is Connie Schultz, is a columnist for The Plain Dealer, and she writes two columns a week, always about social justice, always about the things that this country stands for and the values we share. Yet too much of the mainstream media continues to kind of front for corporate interest, as way too many people in Congress do.
We've got a few callers waiting patiently, but there's a couple things I want to raise with you, Sherrod, before we get off the air. You're from Ohio. I know you were an active supporter of the Kerry candidacy for presidency. And if I recall offhand, I heard indirectly through our friend John Nichols, you anticipated that Kerry would win Ohio. And of course, he did not. At least we don't think he did. What's your take on what happened in Ohio on Election Day and what's happened in Ohio since then?
I think that we lost Ohio for the same reason we lost the country, the popular vote, and that is that people believe, for whatever reason, I don't believe it, but people believe they're safer with George Bush as president, even though he didn't, you know, even though he betrayed the country and telling us things not true about going into war and all the other reasons that I don't think we are safer. But I think enough of the public bought that. The fact that we only nationally won women's votes, that Kerry only won among women by 3%, tells me that too many women
just believed that Kerry wouldn't make us as safe as George Bush does. I'm puzzled by that, but I guess I understand it. I think in Ohio what happened is the Republicans spent $20 million on television going after John Kerry's character, just day after day after day, negative ads about Kerry himself, about his war record, about his quote-unquote being a liberal, about all those things. And we weren't able, apparently, to fight back well enough. But again, we lost Ohio by about what we lost the country. In terms of what's happened since, two things. One is some people are insisting every vote be counted, and I think if every vote were counted fairly, the margin would drop to under 100,000, and that would mean if 50,000 people had switched their votes, there'd be a new president. So this is a very close race. There's no mandate. There's no overwhelming, decisive victory. But the second thing that's happened is thousands of Ohioans, and I've been to some of these meetings where over 100 people show up, just small groups around the state, want to fight back and want to stay engaged and want to take our country back, because I think so many new people got involved in this campaign that have never been involved in politics, understanding what 4 years of George Bush means to the country. And that's why I think you're going to see a sort of a rejuvenated, not just Democratic group of party people, but rejuvenated citizenry out there who really is going to resist when George Bush says, let's all work together, on my terms, let's privatize Social Security, let's allow more corporate control of the media, let's do all these things that the public didn't vote for. I don't know anybody that voted to privatize Social Security, but that's what he's talking about now. And I don't think people voted to do more tax cuts for the richest people in the country and then cut student loan programs and cut programs for working families and for poor people or across this country.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Representative Sherrod Brown.
Hi. I wanted to sort of approach the response to economic globalization in two ways, or ask you to choose one of them, I guess, because there's so little time. But there is this nativist response that I think we have to avoid. The figures on China that we give for how much the trade deficit is with them, I think should always be pointed out with the caveat that it is U.S. multinationals that have a lion's share of that profit and production, and that we do have to look at them as shipping U.S. jobs over to high repression, low wage areas. But the other thing I wanted to emphasize is that there is a different wind blowing in other places. In Latin America, a number of governments have changed and are abandoning the Washington consensus and the neoliberal economics. The Free Trade of Americas Act is going to be much harder to negotiate, and not just because of grain subsidies in this country, which are really flagrant, but a flagrant violation of the so-called spirit of free trade. But they are just weighing other values higher, and I think that we should take heart from that and try to be more internationalist about it. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, those are two very interesting points. Why don't you comment on them?
Yeah, very good points. And I've always been careful, as most people on our side have been on this, never to be nativist, never to be jingoistic, never to blame workers in the developing world. I mean, I blame Mexican investors as I do American investors for driving trade policy, the elite in both countries. But it's pretty clear that these trade policies hurt Mexican workers more than they hurt anybody else. They hurt American workers too, but Mexican workers the most. And it's important that we always refrain and keep at arm's length those people who are against these agreements because they want to close the borders, the Pat Buchanans of the world. While they and we come down on the same side, ultimately, on the final vote, we don't share their values, and we'll never share their values. And I very much appreciate your bringing that out. The good news that you point out for FTAA is what's happening in Venezuela and Brazil, particularly. These are two countries that really do believe in the leaders who genuinely, I think, have stood up for. Stood up for those encroached, particularly in Brazil, where the president there has clearly made it clear that he's his
defiantly, in a sense, made it clear that his major allegiance is to the poor and the working poor and working class voters in his country, and he's not willing to sign an FTAA or any other agreement that betrays them. And I think that's going to force some concessions from the U.S. If the U.S. government wants these trade agreements badly enough, and Brazil is so big, Brazil's the biggest country south of the border, as you know, bigger than Mexico even, and certainly the biggest by far in South America, that that there's going to be some different looks at all of this. And he's a real ally in our, I think, our moving towards fair trade rather than this corporate-dominated free trade.
We've only got a couple minutes left. I've got a couple of callers. Line 4, Ithaca, New York, you're on the air with Sherrod Brown. If you could be brief, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, I would just like you to comment on the relationship between free trade and the international groups that are pushing stricter control in intellectual property rights, and I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Sure. You may be referring to drug issues, I would imagine.
Also media copyright, but tariffs, or not tariffs, excuse me, but patent law and drugs, I think, are certainly part of it, too.
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an expert on patent law. I do know that our government has always shown more interest in protecting intellectual property than it has workers' rights. And I would hope that we would look a little bit, would look similarly at both of those in some sense, that we particularly when we've protected in the area of prescription drugs, which I know more about than I do the other, that we've far too often sided with the Western drug companies against the poor in Brazil or Africa or India. But I think that needs to be negotiated with these other parts of the agreements to make sure that you know, while we respect property rights, intellectual property rights, as we should, we also need to take into concern into our whole thought process what's happened, especially with drug patents were lengthened as a result of our joining the WTO and all that that's brought.
Line 2, Charleston, you're the last caller for Representative Sherrod Brown.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment with reference to one of the earlier callers. He said that there was some hypocrisy in opening up trade with poor countries and giving them some advantage so they can compete. I would entirely dispute that, and I think one of the factors that's hidden is that we are allowing corporations to move their manufacturing to countries with weaker economies and lower wages and yet opening the market in rich countries to them, so they have no incentive to pay their workers enough to buy their own products. Back in the old days, in order to sell Model Ts, Henry Ford had to pay his workers enough to buy them. But now a corporation can go to a low-wage country, manufacture in that country, but sell to the West, so they don't have to pay their workers enough to buy the product.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Chair, do you have any comment
on
that?
That's maybe the biggest problem of these trade agreements. That, as I said earlier, the CEOs that were walking the halls of Congress on the Chinese trade agreement, it was all about not 1 billion Chinese consumers potentially, but 1 billion Chinese workers to sell back to the West. And as long as they continue to be enticed into authoritarian countries like that, where the workers won't get the right to bargain, organize and bargain collectively and make a decent wage and have freedom of movement that capital has, workers don't, we'll continue to see these kinds of trade agreements and this kind of economic activity.
On that note, Sherrod Brown, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been terrific having you join us.
Bob, thank you very much. Thanks for the good work you keep doing on media issues.
And the next 2 weeks here in Media Matters, we're going to have tape shows for you with Jeff Chester of Central Digital Democracy and David Brock of Media Matters for America. I'll be back in 3 weeks. I want to thank Victor Picard, and I will see you all next week. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Today's